Spider-Man, and Star Fox.
Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm the Irredeemable Shag.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Spider-Man and Star Fox. Did I say classic? Okay, no, Star Fox from Marvel Team Up number 143, cover dated July of 1984. And Shag, we're just continuing Spidey's tour of the Avengers of this era because it was Captain Marvel just before.
Pretty much. I mean, he just needs Captain America and Wasp now because they had Vision and Scarlet Witch. They did that about a year before the period we're in right now. So they almost got all six.
Maybe there's a change coming as well. It's like, do it now because then you're going to have to team up with Hercules and then Dr. Druid.
I was going to say Dr. Druid. The character no one asked to team up with.
Yeah, he's never been in a team up, I think.
Aww.
Not even the Thing.
There's reasons for this, but anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure there. He sort of blew it, you know. He was like small fry, and then when he got to be a big fry, not so great. Okay, so, but it's not about Dr. Druid. It's about Star Fox, so nothing problematic there. It's fine. It's fine.
There's nothing wrong with this character whatsoever. He seems perfectly fine, except I can't stand him. I don't even have any strong feelings one way or another about the character, oddly enough.
Perfect, because now we preface with reasons why we like the guest character.
So I really have never had a lot of exposure to him. That's part of the thing is, you know, as we're going to talk about, we cover his appearances, he kind of vanishes pretty much out of the spotlight pretty quick. So My exposure actually started with this comic. This is the first time I'd ever seen him. And you don't learn as much about him as you think you might in here. Then, you know, I bumped into him here and there, like an Avengers crossover, like, I don't know, Operation Galactic Storm or something like that, right? But, I mean, he's probably amongst the general populace of comic readers, probably best known for being the brother of Thanos, right? Because that's always fun, being compared to your more famous brother. Everyone loves that. So if I had to say what I liked about Star Fox from reading this issue and some other stuff I've read, I love his adventurous spirit, you know, larger than life, kind of like Hercules from the Avengers, right? It's always about having, you know, a big adventure. Now, while his thirst for adventure is fun, his ability to create thirst in others is, as we said, really inappropriate. So I tried to explain Star Fox to my wife, There is no good way to explain his powers, man.
Since I started reading Avengers in that era, I'll always have a fondness for, you know, its members of that time, including Star Fox. But for no particular reason. I'm like you. Yeah, it could go either way. It's like, whatever. I think my favorite thing about Star Fox, actually, is, speaking of explaining him to others, he's one of the names that I throw out in the Oh Hot More Not promo.
Right, right.
And it's the one that Jose responds, that's a video game. So, to me, Star Fox, I mean, needs to be in there. But, I'm pretty sure when the girls get the Star Fox.
Oh, man.
Well, you know what? Look at him. He kind of even looks like Sunboy.
Oh, you know, he does.
Yeah, he's the Levitz era Sunboy type. That's not going to fly.
Go beyond the look. Once they find out what his powers are, my gosh.
Well, anytime that you manipulate people, like anyone who has hypnosis, mind control, emotional manipulation, it's a big no-no. But somehow Purple Man, they liked his slacks, but...
Right, I remember that. Well, Kilgrave, he's pretty awesome. Oh, man. Well, and also the girls are nothing if not unpredictable. So who knows? Maybe they'll surprise us.
Maybe. Let's talk about Star Fox's publication history then.
Sure, yeah. So Star Fox first appeared in The Invincible Iron Man number 55 from February 1973. It was created by Jim Starlin. So I looked that issue up last night. I'm like, okay, I'll read his first appearance. Yeah, he's in like one panel. And they just kind of refer to him as Eros, and that's it. So, okay. So most of Star Fox's subsequent appearances are in various Captain Marvel, you know, Marvel, that is, Captain Marvel comics battling Thanos. And that ranges from like 1973 to 1979. And then around 1982, he begins to branch out. You know, he appears in Contest of the Champions, gives him some much-needed, you know, high-profile appearance. And that led, you know, to Roger Stern's Avengers, you know, beginning with issue 230 in 1983. And he stays part of the team for nearly 3 years. And it's funny, in my mind, it feels like it was a lot longer. Even though I haven't read those issues, it just feels like he was around for a long time. But
yeah, he shows up again, like, later.
Yeah.
He's sort of Avengers adjacent for the rest of the decade.
Exactly. Exactly. So he leaves in 261, which is during Secret Wars 2. But then, just like you mentioned, there's a lot of Avengers adjacent stuff. He, you know, and really where you start to see the most of him is during like Infinity Gauntlet, right? Oh, yeah. Because he's Thanos' brother. So he's got a role to play in those stories. Operation Galactic Storm, stuff like that. You know, or again, tied into Infinity War or Infinity Gauntlet or Crusade, all those Infinity things. So basically, for the first 25 years, though, he's not a major player. He falls into one of two categories. He's either a supporting cast member helping fight against Thanos, or he's the rookie Avenger. So that's really it for the first 25 years. So what happens to Star Fox, you know, once he get past the year 2000?
Well, when the 2000s begin, he stars in Avenger Infinity. There's always key words going on. Avengers Infinity, it's a four-issue miniseries by Roger Stern. Then he had a role to play in Avengers Celestial Quest, where Thanos came back for more, and in Captain Marvel Volumes 4 and 5. But these are really minor compared to the elephant in the room, to the She-Hulk storyline in which Star Fox was accused of sexual assault by a married woman he seduced, apparently using his powers. His defense attorney was Jennifer Walters, and Jen herself came to suspect that he'd used his powers on her back in the day. And this was pretty advanced consent material for 2005. I gotta say, props to Dan Slott for attempting it. But as it turned out, he wasn't guilty of these charges, but other things came to light that weren't really any better, including inspiring Thanos' obsession with death.
Oh, gosh.
And some of this was later retconned away anyway, but the end product was that Star Fox asked Moondragon to shut off the power, but that was also ignored in later storylines. He needed them to make Ultron have an emotional breakdown in Rage of Ultron. It could be useful. But by then, he'd barely been used at all. He was probably toxic after that She-Hulk story. Like, for about 10 years, we don't see him. And after this, he was a regular in the Thanos series. I didn't even know Thanos is a series. After Thanos' apparent death, he forms the Dark Guardians to track down what he believes is Thanos' new body. And that's chronicled in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 5. But in a twist, Thanos actually transferred his mind into Star Fox.
Of course he
Gamora,
did.
Yeah, of course. Gamora kills Star Fox to prevent this. And then Eros is later resurrected in Axe Judgment Day, or AXE Judgment Day. Marvel possibly needs him around in case his MCU self turns out to be popular. But he was played by Harry Styles, so probably not so popular. But we did see him in the mid-credit sequence of the Eternals movie. Like, really not that popular, as it turns out. But he's out there.
Now, before you go bashing Harry Styles, you got to understand my daughter, who was, I don't know what, probably 14 at the time, that's all she cared about in that movie, seeing Harry Styles. I mean, that was the thing, to see him in that scene. So she was super excited, not knowing what Star Fox is.
I saw the movie, like, Isabel, Nat, maybe Shotgun. They were all at Twitter about this. And I was going, who's this guy? It was before the spitting nonsense, you know, from more recently.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. That's right. Yeah, he's going through some bad press. I didn't think about that.
And
yeah.
That's what I meant by really not that popular. But gotcha. So I was more interested in Pip the Troll in that sequence myself, you know.
I could not have rolled my eyes hard enough at that moment. Oh, my gosh. So, all right, but let me ask you. So one thing we're talking around, we're not really saying, is what his powers are. Because in this issue of Marvel Team-Up, they don't actually reveal that he has that power that we're talking about. They hint at it. So, Mr. Ohotmu expert, even though you haven't got that issue yet, what is his power exactly?
Well, he's got all the Eternals powers, which means he's got all the powers. But his particular thing is influencing. He's named Eros. He was mistaken for the god of love and sex back in the Greek era, possibly. He's a human Cupid. He can. He apparently did a whammy on Thanos, so Thanos fell in love with death. So he can do it between these two beings, for example. But most of the time, the way we saw it is like he's influencing people around himself about himself.
Yeah, women are falling all over him, usually, is what's going on.
Yeah, he's the Lothario, but also he may be using those powers to influence them. Like, he's got super sex appeal, but it is a superpower.
Right.
You know, it's not natural. So, unless he can really turn it on and off, which apparently he can. So, maybe they just want to hang out with an Avenger. You know,
Northstar kind of talked about it, like when, because he had a professional skiing career, and he said, "How do I compete without using my powers? Like, how do I know that I am or am not using my powers? It's part of me. It's not like a light switch, you know." And so you got to wonder the same with Star Fox, and you know, I think a way to use him going forward would be, you know, emotion control kind of thing, or can influence emotions and don't just make it about love and sex, because that's just, that's where all of
that's
this...
That's creepy.
Yeah, it goes way down, you know, completely unacceptable level nowadays.
Because we've got other characters that have empathy power type powers, and it doesn't always feel that problematic, although the Hot Squad would say different.
Yeah.
Mind control, emotional control, those are villainous powers.
Yeah.
It's tough to have them in a hero unless you're going to make him extremely conflicted. It could be a really interesting story. But in Bronze Age comics, you know, it smacks more of, we didn't really know what we were doing. We didn't realize that this was sending the wrong message.
Right. Which is why they take Professor X down the wrong path every couple of years.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I didn't mean to sidetrack this, but I just thought it would be worth talking about. Because, again, it nowhere in this comic do they outline that's his power. So.
No, but he nevertheless comes back from a, you know, a group date.
Yep.
And almost puts the whammy on a female character.
Well, she's all over him. I mean, she has very specific designs on sleeping with him. She makes that very clear.
And is that natural? Is that a natural attraction? Or is it his emotional field, his erotic field? We don't know.
Yeah, I gotta say, I mean, who says that ability, again, is like a light switch? It's just part of who you are, you know?
But we'll get into it. Before we open the comic, we should look at the cover. You like this one?
I do. It's a great looking cover. So what you've got is, in the background is a black star field, but then in the foreground, you've got this sort of blue star field image and silhouette of Captain Marvel's head. And then within that, Spider-Man, he's leaping. It's Spider-Man and Star Fox fighting some weird guy with a weird red face that we'll talk more about later. A very, you know, warrior kind of sword and sandal kind of looking kind of guy. So Star Fox and Spider-Man are battling him. Spider-Man's leaping in the foreground, but the background of the blue star field with rainbows and all this stuff of Captain Marvel, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely beautiful.
I think it sort of gives us the vibe that they're going to travel through dimensions, but that they're traveling inside her somehow, that she's the conduit. That's not what happens. I think it might have been a better story. But I really like how they keep Captain Marvel in the cover without giving her, like, you notice her on the second glance, basically. And Spider-Man is a great, great pose. Because he's so bendy, he can really follow the arc of her hair, in this case, and fit the frame. Covered by Greg LaRocque and Joe Rubinstein here.
Yeah, and you know, I love the Spider-Man. First of all, I love the black costume. I really, really love Spider-Man's black costume. And this gives them a great chance to show all the different angles they can do without getting caught up with all the web design, right? Without drawing all the stupid little webs. But they can just use really strong white accents along the muscles to make them, you know, to show you definition and contour. And it just looks great. It's really, really cool. I love your idea about the idea of if the story was if they had gone through Captain Marvel, like she's some sort of celestial being and they passed through her. You're right. That probably would have been a better story. And the bad guy, I think the bad guy's a pretty cool design. Like that, the red, you know, cowl sort of piping or whatever on his face is really scary. He looks very determined, dynamic body language. So overall, I just think it's a great looking cover. I don't think as a kid I even noticed the Captain Marvel outline. Like, I probably was so focused on Spider-Man, I don't even know that I noticed that was her head.
Yeah, it's subtle enough, you know? So, really cool design element. Mm-hmm. And I agree, Spider-Man's black costume, so awesome. But also, I think I've read somewhere that, like, there's some artists who were quite happy with it because drawing the blue and red with all the webs.
Yep.
Is a real bitch.
The white contour lines, which, I mean, fact is, I'll just put it out there, I love this costume so much, I wish Spider-Man was still wearing the black costume. And I understand they can't do that with Venom, the popularity. I would take black costume Spider-Man over Venom every day of the week, man. You know, jettison Venom, give me black costume Spider-Man. Even the costume that, like, responds to his thoughts. Like, I don't know why, maybe it's because of the era I grew up in, but I love that idea.
It could easily make a comeback. Have you seen the movies? In the movies, it's like these costumes can remove the mask with a thought. All the costumes are responsive that way.
That's true. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, kids today would know about this and it wouldn't be confusing. It would be an odd thing. Just hook it up to, like, unstable molecules. They can do that.
Well, the problem is just Venom is too much of an IP now.
Yeah, in this case. Yeah. Although, I mean, I wish the black costume was just in the rotation.
Yeah.
You're going out at night. You want a bit more stealth.
Well, McFarlane did that for a little while. when he started on the Spider-Man, his own Spider-Man book, you know, he had like a two-part story where Spider-Man went in the sewer or something like that. So he wore the stealth costume, and it was great.
Yeah, why not? All right, let's open to page one, and let's start with a synopsis. This one's called Shifts and Planes. It's written by David Michelinie with art by Greg LaRocque and Mike Esposito. In the previous issue, Mad Professor Paulson tried to reduce the world's population by shunting Earth capitals into other dimensions with his Pride machine. Pride for population reduction by interdimensional expulsion. Yeah. Spider-Man and Captain Marvel Monica Rambeau stopped him by destroying the machine, but it seems it has trapped Monica in her light form. As she and Spidey try to figure out what went wrong, Paulson's broken mind being no help at all here, Star Fox comes flying in with Paulson's more lucid assistant. After his date with the Rockettes, consensual we swear, he was caught up by Jarvis, followed the Quinjet's transponder, and here he is, ready for adventure. When Spider-Man passes his hand through Captain Marvel, his Spidey senses tingle, not from danger, but from the spider tracker he left on the machine. In other words, the Pride generator hasn't been destroyed. It's been pushed into another dimension, which is creating interference with our own universe the same way it was affecting Monica's powers adversely when it was here. The assistant confirms it's possible and kitbashes a bracelet that should allow Spidey and Star Fox to home in on the generator. The heroes indeed do pop over to another dimension, where they're quickly attacked by the Mako clan, a bunch of Mad Max-looking dudes with D&D weapons. The heroes have things in hand, but balls of fire start streaking through the air and scare the Mako away. Enter the Elysians, a tribe of equally post-apocalyptic Amazons. Armed with sun crystals, they can throw like boomerangs to scare their enemies. And the Mako are a cowardly and superstitious lot when it comes to fire. Star Fox immediately starts pouring on the charm, flirting with their leader, Sandia, though the underage member of the hunting party, Tambi, crushes on Spider-Man instead. The warriors bring our heroes to their wooden citadel, protected by a field that makes intruders vanish if they come too close. They explain that their world was a peaceful one once, and the Mako were pretty harmless. But then a new tribal leader called Will Killer took power, and the Elysians have been suffering attacks ever since. They would have been wiped out if they hadn't found a mysterious machine weeks ago, so it seems time doesn't move at the same rate here. The Pride Generator, which is responsible for that field. But could the heroes perhaps help them defeat the Mako once and for all? Sandia asks them to sleep on it, though it's clear she doesn't mean for Star Fox to get much sleep. It's going to be consensual, we sir. But Spider-Man reminds Star Fox this is a code-approved book, and they should probably bunk together tonight.
I'll take it from here. So Spidey and Star Fox need to destroy the Pride generator in order to return Monica Rambeau to normal. But in doing so, they're going to end up leaving the Elysian warrior women at the mercy of the Mako brutish males. So the Manhattan Marvels decide the only way to keep the Elysian people safe is to neutralize the threat of the Makos. So Star Fox flies the duo to the Mako camp, which is absolutely terrifies Spider-Man along the way. He's convinced he's going to crash to his death. Star Fox decides the best way to defeat the Mako is to challenge their leader. So Star Fox is extremely confident that he can easily best the massive Will Killer. However, something in this dimension makes Star Fox incredibly ill, just moments, mere moments before the battle, and he tells Spider-Man that he'll have to fight Will Killer in his place. Well, isn't that convenient, Star Fox? So the massive and brutal Will Killer leaves Spider-Man on the defensive. This huge warrior, he manages to get in some pretty powerful blows, proving that he is more than a match against Spider-Man. In a last-ditch effort to survive, the wall crawler leaps away from the Will Killer. As the cliff beneath Will Killer crumbles away, he plummets to his doom. Star Fox fights off his illness and helps topple the fire tower down among the Mako camp. So the pair return to the Elysians as triumphant and tell them of their victory, and they gladly deactivate the Pride generator. With their mission complete, Spider-Man drags Star Fox back to their dimension before he can delay the return with yet another romantic interlude with the leader of the Elysian, Sandria. Pero narrowly makes it back, but are helped across the dimensional void by Monica Rambeau, who has been restored to normal. With their adventure over, the captain thanks her two allies for their help. Spider-Man says if it was up to him, he'd prefer the A-Train over all this dimension hopping. Next issue, Spider-Man and Moon Knight. So what'd you think, buddy?
Amusing.
Okay.
Right? This is what I wanted last time, that there was a interdimensional team-up. It's not interdimensional as far as team-ups go because Star Fox is from the here and now.
Right.
So I kind of wish there was like they found, I don't know, Thundra or, you know, somebody that just lives in the otherware, the Micronauts, you know, something.
There you go, yeah.
But, I mean, for what it is, I felt like it was a cute little adventure, Spider-Man kind of out of his depth mm-hmm. in this kind of story. A lot of exuberance from Star Fox. Yeah, I thought it was fun.
Fun is probably the right word for it. I mean, it's not deep. You're not going to walk away here and make notes in the margin to make sure it's in Marvel Universe or anything like that. It's just fun. The biggest takeaway for me, though, is basically they've wandered into a standard fantasy comic book. Right, I mean, this could have been the plot of Warlord or Conan or Kull or any of those things, man. Because you've got the protagonists, they're new to the area. There's two warring factions with clearly different physical characteristics. You know, there's fantasy era weapons and magical abilities, you know, like the sun crystals and stuff. A local woman falls for the protagonist. You know, the protagonist stopped the bad guy faction. They destroy the MacGuffin, you know, device, and everyone is happy and lives in joy. So it's really a standard fantasy-based plot to me, and Star Fox and Spider-Man just happen to be in it, which is fine, because again, like you said, it's fun.
I think that's what you want to do with something like so much steeped in tropes
yeah.
like this. It would be a very normal, ordinary adventure for Conan, for you know, most anyone who comes from that setting. But with Spider-Man and Star Fox, you got superheroes in this. It's like doing, okay, something happens, and it's Spider-Man and Star Fox in a Western.
Yeah.
You know, and it can be all the tropes, and it can be like the most bog ordinary Western story, or in this case, fantasy story you can imagine. But because it's superheroes and they're using their particular abilities, etc., that's the twist.
The only detractor from that is, like, I almost feel like they could have just done this story as a one-shot that, you know, somehow Star Fox and Spider-Man got shunted to this other world. I mean, the plot of Captain Marvel is almost tacked on at the beginning and the end. It almost feels like there's a story in the middle, and they just used Captain Marvel as the reason they had to go there, rather than just telling the story of Spider-Man and Star Fox are transported there, and they meet some people, and they help them, and they free them. So, I don't know.
She's the NPC in the inn who gives them the quest.
That is exactly the best way you could have ever described that. Well done. As much as I was fussing about it being tacked on, I do like that about Marvel Team-Up, that the writers are clever enough to find a way to continue the story from issue to issue, because, I mean, it could be something where you don't get the kids to come back and, you know, pay their 75 cents or whatever to get the issue. But, yeah, anyway, it works well.
Let's talk a little bit about that prologue, if we call it that, where there's the whole recap and, you know, before they go to the other dimension.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off, we begin on Captain Marvel in her light form, because she's trapped in her light form, crying tears of what? It looks like water coming out of her energy form.
Does
this
okay.
make sense?
I see what you're saying. Well, I'll counterpoint you there. Like, I mean,
okay, no prize me.
Well, it's not so much a no prize. It's the whole energy form is just a representation of what she looks like anyway. I mean, she's just energy. She doesn't have eyeballs. She doesn't have a nose. She doesn't have hair. She's just energy. So she could look like anything. So I think her own sense of self is what makes her look like a person. So therefore, you know, she feels as she's crying so that the tears would appear as well, I would say.
Good job. That's a no prize.
All right.
I'll send you the envelope. There's nothing in it.
What I wanted to say is this splash page is freaking gorgeous. Like, if you told me this splash page was a Dennis Cohen drawing, I would believe you. It just looks great.
You're right. It's got that feeling, yeah.
It looks awesome. I mean, you can see her individual teeth, and yet it doesn't get too bogged down in details, and yet you can still make out everything. I mean, her nostrils, her eyelashes, all of it. It's, wow. I think it's stunning.
It's kind of surprising sometimes. I feel like Greg LaRocque, especially early in his career, sometimes it's a little wonky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you're not too sure of the proportions or the perspective. Like, look at the very next page. I know they're far from each other, but it's like they're Captain Marvel's gigantic, you know, and Professor Paulson is tiny. And, you know, how deep is this room?
Right,
but,
right.
So there's stuff like this, because I remember it a lot from when he was doing Legion.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it get pretty wonky. But nevertheless, it's like maybe Mike Esposito was doing a lot of the heavy lifting on that particular, on the splash page. But it really, really looks gorgeous.
It could be. I don't think Esposito's known as a light-handed inker. I think he's pretty heavy-handed on his inking. So I got a question for you here.
Okay.
The whole thing that Spider-Man goes on about, and this random theory he pulls out of his butt, which is that her body, her physical body, and her energy body switch places, right? He says, like, oh, your physical body goes to another dimension, your energy body comes here. So she's like Miracle Man? Or are they trying to say she's like the other Captain Marvel when it was Rick Jones and they would swap places? Is that what he's going for?
I think that's a nice link. But from Ohatmu, this is a pretty standard explanation for powers.
Okay.
I'm thinking particularly of Ant-Man, Giant-Man. There's like a Pym dimension where the mass goes or comes from. Like, you can't grow to giant size. Where does the mass go? Like, who's who would say, who cares?
Right, exactly.
Not so Marvel Universe. You know, they go into, let's find a way why this makes sense in some sort of scientific world. And I think this is what they came up with Captain Marvel. Is that, well, you know, her mass, she becomes energy, but where does the mass go? The mass is shunted to a pocket dimension, which is a pocket dimension of just mass. There's nothing there, just abstract mass. So her body's there, but I guess maybe that, and then she becomes energy. That energy comes from a pocket dimension of energy, whatever. But I suppose there is this this thing in her origin story where it was like there was a dimensional element to the machine that gave her her powers. So it's all linked to that. So it was probably like baked into the character from the beginning. If this was actually in the origin.
Okay. Seems overly complex to me.
I agree. But then you need it to say, like, this whole machine was creating problems for her because her powers come from another dimension, and this thing was interfering with other dimensions by opening too many portals.
Okay. It is such a crock. I'm sorry. Spider-Man comes up with, like, this wild theory, right, that he does one little tiny test and goes, oh, I was right. We should go to another dimension now. That we might not be able to come back from, because we might be able to save you. Like, what? I thought you were a scientist, Parker. Shouldn't you do at least one more test or a couple more tests to make sure before you put yours and Star Fox's life on the line? Because it seems kind of crazy.
And only then do they bring in, you know, the assistant who says, yeah, that's legit.
Right! He's like, well, he didn't say legit. He's like, I don't know, maybe. I mean, the whole scientific principle possible. Is maybe, sure, anything's possible. Monkeys might fly out my butt.
Let's just get on with it. You know, this is a superhero story. We got to do this. We got to go to another dimension. Again, it would have worked better if this was a story where, not going through Captain Marvel necessarily, but when the Pride Machine goes haywire, Spider-Man wakes up in another dimension.
Yeah, there you go. That would have
worked. So you avoid all of this nonsense. He's just trapped there, and then he finds the Pride Machine.
Yeah.
And you team up with someone from that dimension.
That would have been
whatever
good.
It is.
Claw the Conqueror.
Claw? Isn't Claw?
He's DC.
Marvel has a lot of extra dimensions, so there could have been all sorts of characters, you know, on the other side. It could have been Clea, you know, it could have been anything.
Right, yeah.
My only other note from this section is that on page 4, there's a word balloon that misspells trainee, which to me is always very weird in the pre-digital lettering age. Two N's to trainee, which is, I don't know, sometimes it happens, I guess.
Yeah. Well, like you said, think about how many letters this guy's are writing every week to keep up. Because he's probably not just doing this comic. He's probably doing 7 more comics at Marvel. So I know my spelling's atrocious. So
yeah. You say guy, but it's Diana Albers.
I apologize. I just meant as general person. I was not trying to assign a gender. My mistake.
Then the... of course, when they leave, I just want to note Star Fox's posture.
Yeah.
Farewell!
Well, it's a silhouette, too, which makes it look even cooler.
The posture there for Spider-Man, and really his attitude throughout is this guy. You know, it's kind of going like, oh, this guy. Oh, I can't believe I'm with this guy. You know, even that posture there where his silhouette is behind, he's being eclipsed in his own book,
right?
By his guest star, who's like being brash. And I really like Star Fox's energy in this.
Yeah. The bravado is a lot of fun. That's why I compared him to Hercules, you know, from Avengers. You know, he's larger than life. You know, let's go adventure. Let's go, you know. It's almost like I expect him to say, like, let's go to the tavern and find the wenches and have fun. You know, like, you know, it's a bigger, larger than life kind of character.
He's into glory. He's into women. He's into fun.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's Uncle Ben has yet to die, you know.
Oh,
well, he does.
Wow.
I mean, he does get darker in the 2000s after the whole Thanos thing. He becomes very much, thinks of himself as responsible for Thanos.
Huh, okay.
And I think that darkens the character considerably. But at this point, he's a young 1,000-year-old man, boy. But Spider-Man all the way through is going to go, oh, God, you know, he's in for the glory, or he's pulling him away from women. And so Spider-Man is the joy killer in this one.
I'm right there with you, Pete. Don't worry.
So what do you think of this alien world?
It's nice enough. It doesn't look as alien as they make it out to sound like. They make it sound like it's this insane world they've never seen before, but it just looks like, I don't know, a bunch of rocks and some water. Doesn't, you know, a little bit of, as you said, Mad Max kind of desert. Doesn't look that crazy.
Yeah, Spider-Man's kind of standing on Vasquez rocks there.
Yeah.
For Star Trek fans.
Star Fox is wearing a red shirt. But I do want to point out, like, so the fight starts, right, with the Makos. This one guy throws a mace at Spider-Man. And then it is on like Donkey Kong. They're just going in, weighing in, and beating the crap out of this entire group of guys. At no point did Star Fox or Spider-Man, you know, try and go, hey, wait a minute, maybe we had a misunderstanding. We don't mean you any harm. None of that. It is beatdown time for our heroes.
Just the look of these guys. They kind of look like street punks in a way.
When you said Mad Max, I mean, that's really what they're going for. Absolutely.
And when the women show up, it's similar. There's a little more detail put into these particular characters, I guess. But it's still kind of the padding with the tunics. It's a little bit headbands. It's a little bit of everything, you know, a little bit barbarian, a little bit cyberpunk.
Well, and there's a lot of focus on weapons too, which are more fantasy based, because you get like the sun crystal, which is basically magic, you know. Then you got this guy's mace, which is more on the mechanical side. It's got like an extending chain. He's got a staff that throws throwing stars, because, you know, ninja throwing stars, because, you know, it's the 1980s. But it was kind of a weird development how much time they spent on the weapons. I mean, they really talked about them quite a bit, considering the amount of landscape they have here to use. So I just didn't know if Michelinie was like planning to use them again, or was just really having fun developing the world. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, good point. I think the sun crystals, or whatever they're called, they show up a lot to send a beacon so that they let you into the town. So there's a problem with going in and out of the town. So when they do like their secret mission, they gotta wait. And it shows that the Mako are afraid of fire. So then later, when Star Fox pushes the tower, the flaming pyre,
right,
then they scatter because of that. Although, you know what? I don't think being afraid of fire is all that irrational.
Right? Yeah, that's fair. I'm afraid of it when it's near my face.
I'm looking at the picture of the women, that tribe, their hero shot.
Mm-hmm.
Stars are all coming back. And you see there's like different other weapons, and they've got like different looks.
They got nunchucks.
Yeah, there's a nunchuck one. And Tandy, the younger one, it gives me real Jack Kirby vibes.
I was just thinking that. Yep, absolutely.
Even the posture.
Yeah. Very New Gods, young hero vibes.
We see that Star Fox is immediately, dear lady, how could one even tolerate creatures who would gain the enmity of such an entrancing and gracious band as yours? And Spider-Man's already thinking, oh, God.
This guy spreads it thicker than jam on a muffin. That's what he's thinking.
But you see that Tambi, or whatever her name is, Tambi, has a little heart in her thought bubble, so she's into the spider. She's never seen a man like him.
Well, she's all of, like, what, maybe 14, maybe 13?
Exactly. She's supposed to be, like, a very young character, so she got, like, a little crush. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how Spider-Man reacts to that compared to... There's a contrast between, you know, with Star Fox, and, of course, he goes for the leader of the tribe.
Oh, she goes for him!
Well, yes, but I think he's into it.
Yeah, totally.
Page 9, the fight that we don't get, but I wish we did. The lizard and the cat.
I love that. I'm glad you noticed it too. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's just like, you see the crowd is moving away. They're really far away. They're just like black stripes in the foreground. LaRock has gone and put like a little, like, this world is all about conflict. It's about survival, and you can see these animals fighting each other. And it really does look like one of those hairless cats, but green.
Sitting on top of a mushroom.
It's another dimension.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
In the town itself, like, at first I thought, oh, is this going to be all the men are on one side and all the women are on the other side? But it's just about who fights in each of the civilizations they've got. They don't need the other tribe to breed or anything. And that could have been part of the plot where, oh, Star Fox, well, we need men from time to time. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
To propagate the Elysians. And here is one where, like, Tembi looks super small. Like I said, it's like sometimes the proportions, I feel, are a little odd. What do you think of Spider-Man's attitude towards a crush?
he's feeling, literally calls himself chopped liver in his own mind because everyone's fawning all over Star Fox. And he's feeling left out. I mean, he's the second prettiest girl at the party, you know, kind of thing. And then the little girl gives him attention. He literally says, little lady, you just made my day. And I think Peter, he just wants to be acknowledged. That's all. He's not looking for a romantic crush. He's got Felicia back home. He's got, you know, whatever's going on in his life. And so, no, he appreciates that someone noticed him. That's all.
His reaction is very much that of an adult who, you know, treating that crush as valid, but also not engaging with it. So
yeah, it's absolutely appropriate. It's absolutely appropriate. So, which is not, as opposed to everything Star Fox does in this issue with women.
Immediately afterwards, it's Star Fox being handed food and drink, you know, by some lovely ladies. Spider-Man, I like the way he's lounging there.
Okay, he's chilling. That's true.
Sitting on his back almost. It's a funny visual to me. Like for him, this is boring. Can we get on with it? You know, because it seems to be Star Fox's time.
And I think this is an example where the artist recognizes they can do more stuff with this costume. Because showing Spider-Man's full body in that kind of position would be a pain in the butt if he had to draw the webs. So here it's like, okay, I can show more of his body. I can, you know, and we get two panels that have his full body in it in this page. So I think it's a chance where the artist goes, hey, I can do more with Spider-Man's full figure now.
They do reveal then that they've got the Pride machine. You know, Spider-Man starts thinking here, but this is the moment. This is the moment where Sandhya has her hand on Star Fox. He's got a strange expression. She's made special arrangements for him. Not for Spider-Man.
It's the choice of words, but you must sleep on your decision. Arrangements have been made. Special arrangements for you, Flame Hair. As you said, with the touching and the eyes and like, oh my God. Spider-Man literally has to pull him back and go, all right, Romeo, you know, now's not the time.
To his credit, he says, he sighs, but he says, I suppose you're right. So he goes to strategize with Spider-Man in their tent. And Sandhya probably thinks, well, I guess, you know, I guess they're partners.
Oh, right. He also just left a date with all of the Rockettes. The man might be a little worn out also.
I think he's got that eternal constitution.
Oh, God. You know, we don't need to have this conversation.
And yet, the comic asks us to. But they have that secret mission. At this point, I'm like, you know, Spider-Man having to fly on Star Fox's back, I think is a bit insult to injury, given what he thinks of Star Fox.
Right.
He acts like he's afraid, but also it's like, oh, Lord.
Well, he seems overly afraid. I mean, it's not like this is the first time he's flown around on anybody, you know, or whatever. And worst case scenario, if he falls off, he could create, you know, a web parachute like he does all the time or something like that. So it does seem a little over the top.
Spider-Man isn't afraid of heights.
Yeah, good point.
And then, the Mako reveal there. And again, the Mako are all sorts of sizes. They've got a really big one. It's probably like 10 feet tall.
Looks like it.
Will Killer, we finally see his face close up. Within these pages, when they fight, etc. And it really looks like, I thought, well, is it like a piece of fabric or is it like a piece of, like a helmet type, an open helmet? Could it be like tattoos? And I'm looking at those lines around his mouth and they look like yarn. They look like actual stitches.
Page 18, you're right. It does look like those are stitched into his face. Now, the rest of the cowl, it just looks like something he either wears or his head is shaved and it's painted, one or the other. But yeah, those strings literally look like they're laced through his face, which, ow!
But it would be like a very much tribal kind of move. And it makes him look like he's got like almost like a skull face. You know, the teeth are on. Yeah. Look at other people, like even on that page, there's like one guy, he's got the same, it's green, but he's got the same kind of stitches, lines, tattoos, helmet thing, you know, so this is part of their culture.
Yeesh. We're going to start doing that at the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I think. Every host is going to have to get some sort of facial thing like this.
I'll stitch my lips together.
We would all thank you for that, actually. So, all right, so the final confrontation here. So they're fighting Will Killer. You know, Star Fox, of course, you know, has a tummy ache, so he can't fight, which is ludicrous.
Cramps.
Yeah, right, cramps. And the Spider-Man fight's pretty good. I mean, it's what you want, right? You're reading a Spider-Man comic, so you want, like, I don't know, what is this, 5-6 pages of a fight, which is exciting. It's fun to see him swing around. He's trying to, you know, he doesn't have any skyscrapers he can swing off of. He doesn't have his typical, you know, environment to work from. So Spider-Man's struggling, but the big moment you got to talk about is, you know, Spider-Man's on the ground. The guy's holding a rock over Spider-Man's head. He's about to crush him. Spider-Man then, according to what they've written here, he leaps away from Will Killer at the last second, and Will Killer smashes the boulder down where Spider-Man was, and unfortunately they're on a cliff face, and that smashing is enough to make the whole cliff face crumble, and Will Killer falls to his death.
Yeah.
That's what the word balloons tell you. If you just look at the art, it looks to me instead that Spider-Man kicked the dude, and the dude goes flying off and dies. I mean, if you look at the art, isn't that what you're seeing too?
It's ambiguous, okay. But it's maybe because I've read the word balloons, and yeah. I sort of believe that Spider-Man doesn't kill. I just now noticed those spikes at the bottom of the ravine.
Oh, I didn't notice those either. Okay.
So now we understand the grisly deaths, because like Spider-Man, we don't see it. And Spider-Man's like reaching out, like maybe I can catch him or something, or throw some web.
I was going to say he didn't even try and shoot a web.
But it's too late, because he's and then a different thought bubble gone, very tiny scripts. He's seen something gory, perhaps.
I guess so.
Like this whole fight, Spider-Man puts all his strength into his punches, and the guy goes, that hurt, but hardly. Basically, it's almost nothing. So Spider-Man is really out of his depth. But on page, 19, Will Killer slams his head down on the ground, but really the ground is the sound effect. Chud.
Oh, okay. That's nice. I didn't think about it that way.
Yeah, so I like that particular lettering idea. Yeah, Will Killer. Sorry, dude. I don't think Spider-Man kicked him, is what I'm saying. But you're right, the perspective is odd. So if somebody decided that that's what was happening, they could.
I'm just saying, if this was done Marvel style, maybe that's what Greg LaRocque intended. I don't know. And then David Michelinie, you know, changed the wording to be what it needed to be. Either way.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, he goes for him afterwards. I mean, of course, yeah, you push him down the cliff, and you don't know he's going to be dead because he's such a, I don't know, super strong character.
Or maybe you push him and you don't think he's going to fall off the cliff. You think you're just going to push yourself away from him.
But you do see how it's, like, broken, like, rack.
Yeah.
Rack-ish. Ah! And this used to be a point. If you look at the previous page, this was, like, a long...
Oh, yeah.
Like a finger, and that's broken, and that's why he's falling.
Spider-Man's kind of facing the wrong way to jump that direction, though. Like he's his back is to the point where he's gonna like almost gonna fall off the cliff, and yet his leap takes him the other direction.
Yeah, I think the better staging would have been that he flips himself back and sticks to the cliff. Have we forgotten he has these powers?
Right.
Like he just. No, because he actually used it earlier, right?
We didn't see it, but he mentions it, yeah.
He crawled around on that cliff. So do it. Like, stick to the underneath of the cliff. The guy flies over you. He dies. You feel kind of sorry, but you tried to save him.
So if we were in New York, how would this have gone down if Spider-Man fought a bad guy and it resulted in the bad guy's death? Is that like a every other issue kind of thing? Or is that like a, that's not really okay for Spider-Man?
Green Goblin?
Good call, right there. Right in front of me. Should have saw it. All right.
It happens. It happens. It's an accident. And then he feels really bad about it. and he has the traumatic flashbacks about it for years on end.
Okay. That's fair.
But he's never going to be thinking about Will Killer again.
With good reason.
As far as we know. Right.
Right. Until the big MCU. That's what's coming after Secret Wars is the Will Killer saga.
I can't wait. Phase whatever.
Right.
So after this, they fix the situation. The Mako are on the run. They lost their leader. You know, the Elysians are good to their word. They destroy, they smash the Pride machine. They don't need their force field anymore. But then there's a little bit of jeopardy there because as Spider-Man clicks the bracelet to send himself back, you've got a romance going on. Like, Star Fox is really close to Sandia.
Mm-hmm.
And almost doesn't leave.
He wants to stay and get some. Right. And Spider-Man's like, come on, no time for love, Dr. Jones. We gotta go.
And because he waited so long after the bubble effect started, it's Spider-Man who almost doesn't come home.
Well, isn't that how it always goes? Like, the player always has the best luck, and then the Peter Parker of the group is always the one that's got the bad luck. So, yeah, it tracks.
Yeah, the Parker luck makes them, like, he's kind of stuck as if it were, like, a quicksand.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to pull him out, and that's a reveal that Captain Marvel is solid again. I really like that middle panel where they flip him out,
right.
And he's going, Marvel!
Right.
You know, and like the bubble is going around with his motion. I really like that. And then the panel after that, Spider-Man is like sitting on the ground, but the way the shadows are going, it's almost like it's a bench made of shadows.
Okay, yeah, that's fair, yeah.
Again, this is the perspective work of Greg LaRocque. I'm always like, What am I seeing? Am I actually seeing it?
Where is that light source? Yeah, that's a good question, because I'm trying to figure out how that light would make those shadows.
It's like very stark shadows as well. Stage lights, floodlights at the bottom of a stage or something, casting those shadows. I don't know. Like, this ends without Tembi showing up again. So I felt like, I don't know, they built her up. And then Spider-Man doesn't have a goodbye with her?
Well, he does say, as they're disappearing, he says that, say so long to Tembi for me, okay? So at least he remembers she exists.
Is this another case of the writer going, oh, well, Greg forgot to put Tembi in there, so.
Could be. Ran out of pages. Or, you know, what would that goodbye have been that didn't break Tambi's heart? I mean, you know?
I felt like she was introduced as if she was going to be a bigger deal or be in jeopardy or I don't know.
Yes, I would agree with that. Absolutely, yeah. She should have, like, followed him to the Willkiller camp and they had to rescue her at the same time. They were fighting him or something.
We're really good at rewriting these comics. But every time we've talked to comics pros of the era, it was always like, well, you had to do the job. You had to get it out.
Yeah, right.
And that's just how it goes. And we're looking at a finished story, and we're poking holes in it, of course. That's the podcaster's job.
Think about our own work. How many times are you editing a podcast, and you're down to the hour where it's due, and you're just like, you know, I just don't even care anymore. It's done. It's as done as it's going to be. Publish, you know, and it's the same kind of thing. It's a job. It's a job for the writer, and he's got to get it done.
And you're listening to your own voice, and you're, oh, I wish I'd said this, or I'd said that. Maybe I could do an overdub, but who am I kidding?
I can cut out another 20 minutes of shag if I really work on it. I know I can.
But no, one pass through, and that's enough. All right, who fared better? Let's look at our usual topics. How well does this fit each of their stories or atmospheres? Is this a Spider-Man story, or is it more of a Star Fox story, if such a thing exists? Because it takes place in a warrior society on another world, at least more up Star Fox's alley. What do you think?
It could be. I mean, between the two characters, I would say this is definitely a Conan story. Nothing to do with either one of them whatsoever. However, as you pointed out, Star Fox, more the warrior, kind of like, let's go get him kind of thing. It's absolutely not a Spider-Man story. It is completely out of Spider-Man's element. So I guess by default, it's a Star Fox story?
Yeah, it's certainly not a Spider-Man story. It may not be any superhero story normally.
Warlord.
Cool moves. Spider-Man's coolest move, Shag.
Well, I like on page 7, it's pretty early on, it's when they first get there, he does this cool, it's just one panel, it's not even like it's a big, you know, ta-da moment, I just like the way it's drawn out. Spider-Man is doing, it's one of those things where they show him moving across the panel in several different times, and he is swinging across an outcrop of rocks, spins himself around, and he takes out three guys with one swing, boom, 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 and I just caught that and I really liked it.
Three guys, while Star Fox only took care of two in that same panel. Bravo. Yeah, bravo, yeah. Spidey. I will say running from Willkiller, only to climb back up the cliff behind him for a surprise attack. It's still Willkiller who comes out of it seeming cool.
Yeah.
Because he can take that punch. But nevertheless, I like the Spider-Man is thinking three-dimensionally as Spider-Man should.
Yeah, that's fair. And then that double-fisted punch is pretty great.
What about Star Fox? I'll say that even though he has cramps, Star Fox still manages to pull that giant pyre down, making the Mako scatter. So
and that works well because, you know, they set that up earlier, the fear of the fire. So it's there in the script, so it pays off. And I have to agree. You pick the right moment. There really isn't anything else to pick, really. I mean, he does throw a couple punches early on, but yeah, that's the moment.
He's got some cool posing.
Well, sure, sure.
You know, when he flies in originally in the lab on page 4, that's a great pose. When he teleports away, it's a great pose. He's a poser.
Nothing's going to beat that farewell pose. So yeah, farewell.
What about dumb or weird moves then? Spider-Man, he should be reasonably comfortable with heights. So I'm going to say this whole thing where he's alarmed at being on Star Fox's back. They're not that high up. Of course, if this were the 1960s cartoon show, he could just swing off clouds, you know?
Good point. That's fair. Yeah.
They use the same animation, even though it's like, wait, right. He's in a desert.
Right. I would say that Spider-Man's dumbest move is the whole premise of going to the other dimension. You know, he risks his life in Star Fox on some half-baked pseudoscience idea to travel to another universe. Basically, a frankly insane, you know, hypothesis with nothing to back it up whatsoever. Because it might help Captain Marvel. You know, it's, I can come up with an absolutely insane hypothesis. I'm not going to go risk everyone's life on it. And, you know, also, what if they fail? They're still leaving Captain Marvel high and dry. So it just was, I realized it needed it to move the plot forward. I got it. But if I got to say something was bonkers, that's one of the one.
Yeah, I think in the normal day, Spider-Man would say, oh gosh, let's call the Fantastic Four. Maybe Reed Richards knows what to do.
Right, exactly.
Right? That's more up their alley. Or at least the other Avengers or, you know.
There was no ticking clock that said we have to go to the other dimension right now.
No, well, you can stand to watch Monica cry. You know, it's what it is. What about Star Fox's weird moves?
Oh, okay. So his is absolutely challenging the bad guy to a one-on-one battle and then instantly getting a tummy ache, right? You know, leaving Spider-Man to battle the big bad all on his own. You know, that's not the kind of friend I want. Now, just so you folks at home know, Siskoid pulls this crap all the time, at all of our fire and water brawls. He just leaves the other guy standing there. Take your Pepto and get up here, Siskoid.
I'm not feeling so good. Convenient cramps. And they're never really explained. Like, they are telegraphed. There's a moment where he feels lightheaded when he's talking to Sandia, but they really never explain, what is this? Interdimensional sickness? Did he catch a bug? There's nothing that happens to him that doesn't also happen to Spider-Man.
I did not pick up on the moment where he said he felt lightheaded. Okay, I thought he was just flirting. All right, so there's a little bit there. But yeah, it's a waste. I get it. Again, it's to make Spider-Man the star and make the big fight. But either way, I do have a second choice, which would be, why would Star Fox ever leave a party with the Rockettes? I mean, that's just a dumb move right there.
Hopefully, the Rockettes are doing shifts so it can keep the party going. But normally, even though he has the stamina, maybe the Rockettes need to go home at some point.
And it was completely consensual.
Of course. Then the friendly farewell. It's our team-up tradition. How does this one rate? Monica is very appreciative, of course, and Star Fox had a grand old time. But Spidey is a bit like, yeah, I guess, but never again. This has been his relationship with Star Fox the whole way through.
Yeah, no, I agree. You kind of summed it up. I mean, Monica is being genuinely thankful, which is nice. I'm glad they put that in there. I mean, there's a whole panel of her just saying thank you. And I feel like, you know, this should have ended with Star Fox yelling something like, outrageous, you know, from like Aquaman Brave and the Bold kind of style.
He would be that character if you weren't toxic.
Yeah.
This is how you would play him. He's Pepe Le Pew, but... That's also become a sort of problematic figure. So, but yeah, Star Fox in animation would be a lot of fun, but he'd be more like in this issue rather than some other elements. All right, we'll take a break for a couple of promos. And when we come back, we'll do our special features.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man. I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Doc who?
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics.
When you're out at a club and you see a fly girl, do the creep, and do the creep. And if you want to make friends at the ATM, do the creep.
Amalgam Comics does not condone or encourage creeping. Hashtag consent. Buy the creep every month at your local newsstand, unless we've already canceled it. Only from Amalgam Comics, and maybe not even us.
And don't forget to smile.
We're back, and we're caught in the web. This is a feature where we discuss some of our favorite interactions between Spider-Man and his guest outside of the comic we just featured, if any. Well, Star Fox isn't much of a solo star, right? So for me, I'm going to the Avengers for this, specifically their adventure against Nebula in Avengers 314 to 318. Star Fox was no longer a member, but he did play a big role, and Spider-Man was along for the ride, more or less trying out for the team. But then he decided not to join on account of all this cosmic junk. It's not his vibe. And it shows that they really aren't meant for the same stories. It's hard to see Spider-Man and Star Fox together, you know. So, Shag, what did you pick to discuss between these two across their entire history?
So, as you said, they don't really cross paths very often, and they don't often mesh together. So, my selection is, it's a bit of a cheat. It's from Captain Marvel, issues number 27 to 30 from the year 2002. This is the series about Genis, the son of the original Captain Marvel. So, it's written by Peter David with art by Chris Bautista. And the story involves Captain Marvel and his, quote-unquote, uncle, Star Fox, teaming up for, wait for it, Spider-Man 2099. So Star Fox, in that case, had been mortally wounded, and the answers to his survival are somewhere in the year 2099. So you get a lot of Star Fox and Captain Marvel and Spider-Man 2099 interacting. There are some specific spots where Star Fox and Miguel O'Hara have some fun. Not a ton, but, you know, the pickings, as you said, were pretty slim. And Peter David's always good for a laugh, so it's fun.
I like where you went with this. It's a good loophole.
And Spider-Man 29 is kind of in the news right now, which is kind of cool.
Although he was never... Well, I'm not going to talk about the movie.
I haven't seen it yet, so don't spoil anything.
Okay. So our final feature then, the bonus team-up, in which each of us proposes a perfect Star Fox team-up. What do you got?
If there is such a thing. I don't think I've ever done one with characters from the same company, because I always wanted to try and do cross-company to sort of, you know, pick from the best. But in this case, it made sense. So I guess this team-up could happen someday between Star Fox and Venus from Agents of Atlas. So Venus's main power is the ability to mesmerize others with her voice, you know, generally feelings of love. So both of them are eternal. They both live forever. She's not an eternal, but she is eternal, if you understand the distinction there. So both of them control emotions, you know, love and lust. They're both steeped in mythology, Venus and Eros and all that. So it'd be interesting to see them, you know, in the same adventure, probably trying to enthrall one another. I'm pretty sure Venus would win based on her power level that I've seen in Agents of Atlas. And also, Agents of Atlas is typically written by Jeff Parker, so it'd be one hell of a story, so I'm all for that. And I did Google to see if they'd ever met before. I didn't find anything, but I did find some fan art, which I shared with Siskoid, which is it's Venus, you know, being very demure, but she's being flirtatious. And she's sort of like brushing Star Fox's face, and he's kind of looking on. So it's a fun little idea.
Yeah, I'll put it on in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Oh, okay.
It's cute. And, well, for me, I did go cross-company. Star Fox with Timber Wolf. And it's only to have a knockdown, drag-out fight to see who has the rights to that chest emblem.
What about the hair? Don't they both have kind of the Wolverine-pointed hair, too?
Yeah, they've had. You know, it's like, it depends. But Timber Wolf started off with that when he was Lone Wolf. I probably started the fight when Star Fox winks at Lightning Lass. But after that, it's just ego. I'm writing this thing. Basically, I'm going to make it as stupid as I can. Timberwolf wins in the end because Star Fox doesn't have as much skin in the game. Right? It's just one random person that he's winking to.
That, and he's not drawn by Mike Grell, so he's not showing a lot of skin.
Okay, now it's time for webzingers of our own, which is to say your feedback on our previous episodes together, in which we covered Marvel Team-Up number 142, starring Spider-Man and Captain Marvel. Let's just see how many people you goaded into responding, Shag.
It's all right, true believers. Last time, as Siskoid insinuated there, I did push you guys to leave more comments, and we managed to get double the number of comments as the other team-up episodes. So let's keep this Excelsior level of comments coming, folks. Let us know your thoughts on Star Fox, your favorite Spider-Man, adventure in a fantasy setting, you know, your own imaginary team-ups for Star Fox, all the problems with Star Fox as a character. Either way, leave the comments and let's continue to show those other team-up hosts that Marvel team-up is still the best. All right, so first we heard from Matt Sorois. Now, I'm just sort of picking and choosing bits and pieces of what people wrote because there's a lot here. So he starts off by saying, I absolutely adore Monica Rambeau. She was my Captain Marvel growing up. Then he says, it was a damn shame she was derailed by an absolutely abysmal decision. Not only did the decision to try and make her ineffectual, they depowered her and aged her. She was out of the Avengers and out of comics. It was infuriating. Just a few years ago, she was one of the four characters chosen for the cover of the TSR Marvel RPG. You know, there she is up there with Spider-Man and Captain America and The Thing. One of my favorite Monica stories is Avengers 255, features Monica heading into deep space to investigate Thanos' starship Sanctuary 2. This leads to star-spanning adventure that introduced Nebula, daughter of Thanos. All right. Well, thank you for sharing, Matt.
Yeah, and he mentions your favorite Marvel RPG, right?
Yeah.
So that's how you get named in the comments. Actually, we're going to name everyone. So next up is one of those co-hosts that you just trash-talked, Chris Franklin. Says, shots fired among the co-hosts. I'll bribe the listeners to comment more on BNB, okay? He says, I was here on the ground floor for Monica Rambeau as well with that Amazing Spider-Man annual. I remember as a kid thinking, hey, how come this is happening in a Spider-Man comic? Who is this lady? How is she Captain Marvel? This was partially because I was only vaguely aware of Marvel, but I was a big fan of the Big Red Cheese, who had a live-action TV show, a cartoon in the Kid Superpower Hour with Shazam, and a regular feature in World's Finest, which I never missed. Despite all that, I did like the character and read quite a few issues of the Stern run when I could find it. I didn't realize until years later editorial interference nerfed her. What a crime. Lots of editorial tampering going on in the mid to late 80s Marvel Comics, ruining things Roger Stern had lovingly established. Cough, cough, Hobgoblin.
Oh, yeah.
I'm happy to say my daughter really took a shine to Teyonah Parris' Monica on WandaVision and is excited for her return in the Marvels film, and I am too. It's the next one over, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and now that I think about it, that trailer for the Marvels came out since we did our last episode, and it looks so fun. All right, then we heard from David Ace Gutierrez. He says, I wasn't familiar with this iteration of Captain Marvel until this very issue. I was confused by her links to the original version that I'd only heard of because of Miss Marvel. Like the esteemed Shag, I found her power set confusing and vague, but I loved her nonetheless.
Leslie Traig says, I have liked Monica Rambeau from her days with Avengers in the mid-80s. I've always enjoyed light, energy-powered heroes. Plus, she had a costume that was so different from everyone else. But I never fully liked her being called Captain Marvel. For me, Captain Marvel was Mar-Vell. I had hand-me-down issues with Mar-Vell, Rick Jones, and the Negative Bands. I'm so glad she got a different code name. She has always needed to be her own person. Plus, I'm really enjoying what MCU is doing with her. I hope this helps your ego, Shag.
Thank you, Leslie. Remember, folks, keep those comments coming. So then we heard from Bucky749. Says, here's my imaginary team-up. Captain Marvel from Marvel meets Ghoul from the Ultraverse. Man, Bucky knew how to play me here, didn't he?
Yeah.
He says, when Ghoul is struck by a random gamma beam from the Marvel Universe, he's sent to Avengers Mansion. Star Fox, who stayed up late watching Elvira's zombie marathon, freaks out, making Captain Marvel come see what's going on. And they have a fight. And the next issue, Shaman from Alpha Flight, wow, okay, really hitting all my favorites here, shows up and they fight the Frightful Four, and then Shaman sends Ghoul home. Bucky, I would like to read that comic book. Thank you. Then we're from Matt Wagner, who says, obligatory ego boost for the semi-redeemable Shag. He needs more refinement. Maybe he needs more hours of podcasting experience. I think it's a compliment.
Is it? So Brian Schufo says, I also have a fond and vague memory of the Kid Superpower Hour with Shazam, which you mentioned. Was there really a character called Dirty Trixie? I also recall Black Adam being tricked into saying his magic word and turning to dust because he was 1,000 years old. Yes, there was a Dirty Trixie in that the high school gang. My memories of the show are basically the trio transforming and in Hero High, the character of Weatherman. He had a cloud on his chest.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And Hero High is the guy who rode like the surfboard, right?
Very vague memories as well. But Dirty Trixie did exist, yes. Weren't making it up.
I'd like to point out that twice now you have read the name of that television show incorrectly.
Okay, what is it? The Kid Superpower Hour with Shazam.
Right, but that's not how you say it. You say
how did I say
it? You say Kid Superpower Hour with Shazam. That's how it's supposed to be said. It's very okay. important you get that right. Then we heard from Jason R. Lady, who writes quite a long, like, to trees. Is that the word I'm looking for?
Treaties?
Yeah, thank you. On Captain Marvel. And it's really fascinating. You should go out to the Fire and Water Podcast website to read it. Now, I will read the parts I highlighted if Siskoid will stop screwing around with the document. So Jason writes... I am always glad to see a spotlight on Captain Marvel. I'm a huge fan of this character from way back. Monica Rambeau, under Roger Stern's pen, was powerful, majestic, commanding, compassionate, and heroic. While she had a year or two as a rookie Avenger, she was never a wide-eyed kid in her early days on the team. She was a grown woman who had a career before getting her powers and joining the Avengers. She had a law enforcement experience as an officer in the New Orleans Harbor Patrol and was portrayed as frustrated at the sexism in the system that kept her from rising in the ranks there. The Captain Marvel identity was an acknowledgement of a rank that she deserved. Wow. Okay. Thank you, Jason, for sharing that. Now, I've read her origin, but, you know, that just hadn't stuck with me, all the details. He goes on to say, in the Stern run, she is shown as the Avenger that most concerns Baron Zemo before attacking the mansion, and he has to make a special plan just to contain her. She is shown going toe-to-toe with Zeus and taking on the hordes of Pluto, as she defeated Magneto in about 2 seconds by flying through his force field and zapping him. Boom, done. The X-Men's most powerful foe laid out in no time flat. And then, you know, I mentioned I feel like she's a little too powerful, ambiguous. You know, David A. Gutierrez echoed what I said. Well, Jason's got some different feelings. He says, I don't get the she's too powerful argument against Monica. Comic books are stuffed with characters that could be deemed too powerful. Superman, Supergirl, Flash, Green Lantern, Thor, and any of the Phoenix characters, you know, Silver Surfer, Hercules, etc. All it takes is a writer with the imagination to work with the powers of these characters, showing them to be formidable, but at the same time, not downplaying their powers to make the stories work. Roger Stern, a master of his profession, could pull it off. Not many can. And then at the bottom there, Jason says, you guys were wondering if she often, in her energy form, was rainbow-colored, because, you know, we saw that a lot last issue. He says, rarely, if ever. She's usually just yellow energy, to the point where other Avengers called her the Golden Avenger or Golden One. All right. Well, thank you for dropping the knowledge bombs, Jason.
Golden One sounds like something Hercules would say here. Yeah. Tim Price says, Ryan Daly and I covered Monica's first appearance in an episode of FW Presents back in 2019. So you can look that up. And then he goes on to say, Michelini did okay with her character and powers, but it missed the mark a bit, like with her thoughts on Star Fox. I think David was playing matchmaker too much with those two, something not seen in Avengers, and it's his style to include soap opera drama like that. But I did like being creative with her powers, plus CM getting physical with the bad guys, since that's more instinctive for her. As for that rainbow, I'd have to no-prize it because that is not in her other appearances. Artistic license here. Technically, with enough moisture in the air, her light form could refract like a rainbow, but whatever. I think the creators wanted to play around. Funny about gamma rays, they're one of Captain Marvel's standard moves against tough problems. It worked well against Hulk clones and piercing an impenetrable force field to save the FF, but she tries to be careful using gamma rays. Likewise, she's never used cosmic rays around the FF, which is good since that might induce PTSD.
All right, well, thank you, Tim. Then we heard from Captain Entropy. He talks about Thomas Robert Malthus says he was wrong. You know, we're not overpopulated as a planet. Properly enabled, enough people produce new resources for themselves and others. There are plenty of very nice places in the world with high population density. It's about how we use the resources and whether or not everyone gets a fair shot at them. Now, this is, of course, in reference to the bad guy's plan last issue to shunt all these people to the other side of the planet. Kind of a Thanos-type plan. And then Captain Entropy says, in answer to why I like Monica Rambeau, ditto to everything Jason Lady said earlier, and I can't say it anywhere nearly as articulately. What is this guy, a writer? Yes, folks, that's Jason R. Lady, author of the books Time Problems, Super Problems, and Monster Problems, all on sale now. That was nice of Captain Entropy to give him a plug.
Yeah. Gene Hendricks says, Shag wants more comments on his episodes, huh? Okay, here you go. That announcer for the Amalgam book sounded great.
I'm guessing that wasn't one of my promos. That was probably one of Gene's, huh?
It was one of Gene's, yeah.
I think we're from Martin Gray, says, why do I like Monica Rambeau? Well, Captain Marvel's cool because of her puffy sleeves. Okay, I don't really understand her powers, and she's a bit cranky at the moment in Thunderbolts. Still, it's connecting to her Next Wave persona, but I'm never unhappy to see her. I did try the first issue of her new book, and it was a tad bland. And he says, as Shai pointed out, the issue-to-issue changes in writer didn't mean a lack of consistency in quality, but the quality wasn't amazing. The issues were always decent, but not outstanding. And while Greg Clorock will always have a place in my heart for his Legion work, his art looks a bit clunky at times. Wow, Martin, man, coming with the black rain cloud, buddy. You know, the comics are supposed to be fun. Didn't you teach me that, friend?
You wanted comments.
Right.
That's what it's going to be. Lizanne Oswald says, as for the expression on her face when she's falling out of the sky, I'm not sure how unrealistic that would be, having recently taken a level one skydiving course. It was an indoor skydiving course, and we weren't too high up. But there was one point where it felt like I was going to fall to the ground, and I'm sure my eyes were not too dissimilar to that. And Liz even sent footage. You don't see the eyes, but it's kind of, you know, it's like floating in midair, basically, with blowers or something.
Liz leads a very adventurous life, you know, from learning Russian to this. I mean, very active. I'm impressed, Liz.
Yeah, martial arts weapons.
That's right, all sorts. Yeah. There are from Chris Pine, who says, this was a fun episode covering an issue that, for me, is just okay. I agree with a lot of people here in the comments that Monica as Captain Marvel was a really interesting character, and I loved her in those Stern Avengers issues. It was great to see her put in a position of leadership so quickly. And I enjoy reading characters who feel like they've thrust into the superhero life after acquiring powers, and not because they've had some sort of personal vendetta or goal. I like her design, even though her costume did look like a modified 1980s workout leotard. Makes it look like she was a ballet dancer and just broke out the old outfit. I kind of agree. You know, I've never loved her outfit. It's okay. You know, it's kind of unique with the big wing kind of thing, the big puffy wing thing. But yeah, it's not my favorite look. I like a lot of her designs later that she has.
Ian Fletcher says, I am compelled to comment. This is the Captain Marvel I knew. Thanks. Same for him. The TSR Marvel RPG.
Woo-hoo!
He says, sadly, my friend who bought comics didn't really collect any Avengers of that era, so I never got to read an issue with her in them. If I recall correctly, in one play session of Marvel, someone used Captain Marvel and dominated play, so we put her in the too powerful bucket of characters. When I first read Crisis on Infinite Earths, I thought Dr. Light's costume looked an awful lot like Captain Marvel's, and wondered if she was a nod to that character. Also, on the same bent, I feel like Banshee's classic costume with the gliding wings looks ridiculous, but the same vibe, more exaggerated on Captain Marvel's costume, really works for me.
Oh, I see. I'm the exact opposite. I love Banshee's costume with like the stripes, you know, that look like an old 1920s, you know, I don't know, bathing suit or something like that. I love the way his costume looks with the wings. I think they look fantastic. So, folks, remember, go out to the website, leave your comments there. We've got to keep this momentum going. We want to, you know, put your Star Fox / fiction out there. I don't care. You know, whatever you feel like sharing, or tell us maybe how you could fix the character Star Fox. We want to hear from you.
I can't wait to listen to you reading Star Fox / fic in 4 months. So, okay. Well, on that note, thanks for teaming up with me, Shag. Tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
Oh, sure thing. Right now, the Justice League International Bahaha podcast, we are barreling through breakdowns. So we are on a train that's not going to stop till we get there. So to the end. So it's a lot of ups and downs in breakdowns right now, but it's been years and years in the making. So it's very exciting to be there. Over on my Once Upon a Geek podcast, we are right now covering some issues of Blue Devil. So we're having some fun, me and my buddy Frank, and we've got some interviews with the creators. So we're having fun there. And then there may, or depending on when this is released and depending how much I can twist Rob's arm, there may be an episode of Who's Who in the works, actually.
Okay. Also, a reminder that we do have a Patreon. So if you like this content, want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FWPodcast. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. We do enjoy reading your thoughts. Shag has said it enough. The best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also visit the Fire and Water Podcast Network Facebook page or find us on Twitter at FWPodcast. We'll read your comments on this issue when Shag is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with our friend Chris Franklin as we tackle Brave and the Bold number 80. Start reading on that. See you next time for another amazing superhero team up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.